Hey there, friends, members of the Nerdcore. I welcome you to my newest episode of Talk Nerdy. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm using a new microphone to record the intro of this episode, so I'm interested to see how it sounds, how it turns out. If it works, then my life's about to get a lot easier, so yay. I'd love to hear your thoughts, and I'm always interested in hearing your thoughts. I want to thank you guys so much for your support, for all of your tweets and all of your Facebook messages and your emails. They really help me figure out how to do these episodes, how to keep them fresh. I love to hear what you guys have to say and implement it. And I love that you guys show your amazing support in other ways by reviewing and rating the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and also through your really, really generous donations on my website. There's a little button that says donate now that takes you to a verified secure PayPal screen. And it's hugely helpful for those of you who throw a couple nickels my way, because that really helps keep the podcast 100% free to download. I actually want to go ahead and give a shout out to a couple of you who have done that recently. I want to thank Rick Richardson. And Rick is from, I've got this right here, sorry, my internet's running a bit slow, from Elma, Washington. Thank you so much for your donation. And I also want to thank Matthew Carhart, who sent in a donation from Saverna Park, Maryland. Thank you so very much. It really, really does go a long way to helping get great guests in and helping me be able to dedicate a little bit more of my time to the podcast. I also want to thank those of you who have made purchases via my online store. All of those proceeds go to support the podcast, and it's also a huge help. All right, business out of the way. I'm excited to announce my guest this week. His name is Phil Torres. He's an entomologist, and he is the host of Techno on Al Jazeera America. This is a really cool science show that I also contribute to. It's a show about science by scientists. It's the brawny man himself, Phil Torres.
Hello there.
Hello. Does it bother you that I call you the brawny man?
I prefer like Spider-Man.
But Spider-Man doesn't look like you. I mean, you don't really look like the brawny man, but I think it's like a weird 50s concept of what like the rugged outdoorsy.
I left my flannel at home today, so only half brawny.
All right. Well, I'll see what people think when they see the selfie. Oh, we need to take a selfie.
Oh, we're going to take a selfie.
Yeah, I've been so bad lately about forgetting to take selfies.
Stop being bad at selfies.
Help me remember. All right. So I'm really excited that you're here. Phil and I, we just ate at this sweet little restaurant called Grub. We got our Grub on, and you can walk there from my apartment, which is super fun. And I got the after school special.
She sure did.
Grilled cheese with a tomato soup.
It was delicious.
And you got mac and cheese with pulled pork, which is also amazing.
And a side of crack bacon.
There was also a salad on your plate, I think.
So I like to eat healthy, guys. So a little salad and I'm set. I think that's how it works.
Yeah, I think so. So Phil, we'll tell the people how we know each other. I know you because we worked together on the Al Jazeera America show. Techno. Yeah, and you are the host of this show, Techno.
I am the host of this show.
And tell me about what that entails.
It has been really fun. You know, the theme of the show is looking at science innovation that has real humanity components. So it's not just a cool gadget. It's a cool gadget that can help a paralyzed person walk or just change the way that we're going to live on a day-to-day basis. We also get a look at conservation stuff. I was jumping on sharks last month, which was amazing.
The best episode. So much fun.
It was pretty fun. And you, of course, contribute to it as well.
Mm-hmm. I do. It's so much fun. We get to travel. We get to meet new people. We get to talk to interesting scientists and also learn about innovations that are really on the cutting edge, things that I didn't know about before.
Absolutely.
I, you know, hear about the story that I'm going to be working on. So that's really, really exciting. And we've both been at it. We were in the pilot episode together.
We sure were.
We've been at it from the beginning.
You went to Alaska and I went to Mars.
Oh, yeah. He He went to Pasadena.
The Mars yard. I felt like I was really there, guys.
That's so cool. I still haven't visited JPL, which is stupid. I have a lot of friends there. I know. But how was it for you? Was it really fun?
It was so fun. It's like an adult playground for nerds. It was great. And got to see the Curiosity's like sibling, the rover that's there. And it was so amazing.
And do they let you just wander around the Mars yard, or are they like, you know, they stay within the Velvet
the
Rope?
Mars yard, I was wandering around as far as getting close to the robots to like keep a meter away, 2 meters. And,
God, that's so funny. It's like going in to a foreign country where I remember when I went to the Galapagos, where you've mm-hmm. been to, where it's like, that's the rule. It's like stay a meter away from the wildlife.
That's, you know, their wildlife is a little bit different on Mars.
Yeah.
Looks more like a robot.
So I mentioned that you've been to the Galapagos. You've been to a lot of really, really interesting places. Your background, actually, in the sciences is in entomology.
Entomology.
Which, where does that word actually come from?
I should know this. But basically, basically, it means I study insects and arachnids and other little guys like that. It is a lot of fun.
So there's no distinction in entomology that an arachnid obviously technically is not an insect, but they're both bugs.
They're both bugs. So entomology doesn't technically cover spiders.
Okay.
But in entomology departments, they still have spider biologists. You still take spider courses. So I throw it in there. They're similar enough in what they do.
And you love spiders.
I do.
Okay, so we're going to talk all about all of the fun things that you've gotten to do in your career as young as you are, which makes me shake my fist at thee. But what's, can I ask, is it even possible for you to answer what your favorite bug is?
I can answer that. It is a butterfly. So I grew up studying butterflies was my thing. When I was 7, there was a guy who taught these bug camps for kids, and he was traveling around the world to Brazil, to Africa, to Australia, collecting butterflies and finding new species, and all for science. He was like the Indiana Jones of butterflies. And I was like, that sounds pretty darn cool. So I got to do my first little mini expedition to Nicaragua, which is where my dad's family is from, when I was 15. I emailed the head entomologist of the country, and I was like, hey, I kind of know what I'm doing. Give me a permit to collect here. And he was like, all right, sure. So he gave me a permit, and I collected a bunch of butterflies down in this area called Bartola. And then I went up to this volcano called Mombacho. And I gave him a list of the things I thought I found. And then 2 years later, my uncle who lives there sends me a news article. There's a butterfly that they only had 2 specimens of. It was a new species, and I looked at my collection, and I had caught that one. It's called Napiogenes tolosa mombachoensis. So it is a subspecies of this one butterfly only found on this volcano. And I was 15 years old, and I was like, wow, if I can do this as a 15-year-old just having fun climbing a volcano, swinging a net, imagine what I could do if I really pursue this thing.
Oh, that's so cool. And so what was it like? At break, like over summer, and your parents let you go?
Yeah, I think it was a family vacation, and I dragged them to the rainforest. It was pretty cool. We took a little flight, landed in a field, took a 4-hour boat ride up the Rio San Juan, and there we were in the middle of nowhere. And it was something, my parents tell me that when I was like 6, I would not be able to go to sleep because I would just dream about being in the rainforest.
Aww.
And so they were always very supportive. And so they let me drag the whole family out there. And it was a blast. And it really solidified that is a place that I love the rainforest. It's a place I want to study, I want to work to protect, and I want to work to understand.
And now you've been, I mean, not specifically to that rainforest, but if you could add up all of the times that you've visited that climate, how many times have you been to the rainforest?
Probably maybe 15 times,
wow.
A dozen, 15. Yeah, one of my first summer jobs when I was in college was expedition to Venezuela. Then I got to go to Mongolia. And again, just to study bugs. And it was stupid. It's just the best job I could ask for. I was like 20 and I was in the middle of Mongolia collecting aquatic beetles surrounded by quicksand. And it was like this big adventure.
Oh, that's very, very cool.
And then, Ecuador for a bunch, Peru for a bunch. And
so the Amazon has kind of become something of a second home to you.
It is. I like to call it my second backyard.
Yeah, that's a big backyard.
It is a big backyard.
With a lot of shit that could kill you.
A lot. you know, I'm not afraid of the organisms as much. Well, I guess a tree is an organism. I'm really, like, the thing that I think is the most dangerous down there mm-hmm. is having a tree fall on you.
Oh, jeez.
Because that happens all the time.
Really?
You always hear a huge crash of a tree falling. It's just kind of the natural cycle of a rainforest. Always about 2 to 3% of a rainforest is in what's called a tree fall state. So a giant 6,000-pound tree falls, takes down a bunch of stuff with it, and then everything can form again there. So it's a little pocket of life that forms.
And then you've got all of the fungus and all of the things that are eating the decomp down there.
Exactly.
To be able
so you
to
got
grow
the decomposers, then the colonizers. You get the Cecropia trees are the first big ones to grow in there. Then there's other longer-living plants that come in that need that shade. So you can really see this really interesting progression of life when you get there, but it can also cause death if it lands on you.
Have you heard stories about that happening? Have you known anybody?
I mean, I've seen a friend of mine's pack got crushed one time by a tree, so we were sitting right next to it. I was one time out in Peru. I was oftentimes doing surveys out alone. I was about a mile away.
That seems
and
smart.
Yeah, it's... yeah. Don't tell my mom.
Yeah.
So I was out there and all of a sudden it got really dark and I just was like, I think it's a little bit too early for it to get dark. And I just find a little patch where I could see the sky and it was just some crazy storm was coming. Mm. And then I hear the sound and it sounded like a train was coming. Like it was just really, really intense wind. The most intense wind I've ever seen in the Amazon. And I was like, this is crazy. And all of a sudden, I start to hear things fall.
Oh.
Because these trees are giant. They're covered in plants that weigh them down. They're covered in water that weighs them down. A little push, and a big one is coming down. So
Wow. Basically,
branches were falling left and right. I was literally sprinting out of the rainforest. Trees were falling in front of me to my side. 400-pound branches were falling left and right. It was so crazy.
So you had your Raiders of the Lost Ark moment.
I did. Yeah. You know, I didn't have to like go underneath a boulder, but there was a big tree that fell about halfway down and stopped right in front of me. And I just went right under it and just booked it back. It was crazy.
That's absolutely nutty.
It's part of the job.
It is. And you know, you've made some pretty amazing discoveries as a young scientist, and I might add as a scientist who took a very non-traditional route. So you went to school mm-hmm. to study entomology, yes?
Yeah, went to Cornell.
You went to Cornell.
Go Big Red.
Did you do your undergrad or your master's there?
Yeah, just my undergrad.
And then you started a PhD.
Yes.
And then you said, you know, I'm going to keep doing science on my own.
Well, it's basically... I went the education route for a little bit mm-hmm. after graduating, and then I just really missed being in the field. So I took 2 years of working in the Amazon. I was there most of the time, and it was amazing. And I really feel like that is the ultimate classroom. And I really think I come from a naturalist background. When I was a kid, I would just walk around and just watch things, and I could learn so much about nature that way. And I felt like in the classroom, when I learned about the rainforest and I learned about conservation, it was so different than when I was actually in the rainforest and saw how complex conservation actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So using those 2 years of experience, I then was like, okay, I have a question I think is complicated enough that I'd like to tackle a PhD. I started it, and then I was also working on techno at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got to that, I think you can relate to this.
Oh, yeah. We
talk
about
between,
it often.
Yeah, doing research, which still my brain just loves doing. And I'm still involved in some projects or doing the, you know, the TV, the SciComm, the education.
The outreach, yeah.
Which to me, I mean, outreach was so big, and me becoming a scientist, I just feel like it's a great opportunity for me to give back.
And the truth is, this is one thing that's like my least favorite thing about working in television. And to some extent, I probably, and people like some of our co-hosts on the show, Shinny and Crystal and Marita and some of the other women, like we are going to face things that you aren't necessarily going to face, which is something of, I don't want to say an expiration date, but we have to be conscientious about the fact that females on TV don't get as much work as they get older, which blows.
It's
sucks.
Crazy.
It's something that we're always pushing against and we want to see it change, but it is a problem. And I've definitely talked to, you know, I'm not sure if I'm going to go back and get my PhD, but I have spoken to professors in departments that I'm interested in studying in, and they've said the same thing to me that I've kind of come to understand myself, which is I have amazing opportunities right now, and I have opportunities for outreach that I may not get when I get older, but hopefully I'll always have a home in academia, and I can always return.
Yeah.
And I think that you're probably in a very similar position, but you've been lucky enough to make discoveries both within the academic kind of umbrella and also as you've sort of gone out on your own. I don't mean completely on your own. You went rogue, but you're obviously working with organizations,
right.
Foundations, universities.
But you have, I mean, we were just at your house a little while back, I think for a Cosmos night, a little Nerd Brigade get together. And I remember you were showing us these beautiful macro photographs of butterflies and ants. And you were telling us a whole story about some theories that you had. And I remember thinking the patience that that requires to just, because not only you're in the Amazon, you're in the rainforest, you're not looking at really big things. You're looking at tiny things in the rainforest. You're having to really have this perceptive eye and walk up and find colonies of insects and figure out where they congregate. And you take these amazing macro photographs.
Well, thanks.
And then, oh, they're absolutely beautiful, you guys. We'll figure out how to link to so that people can see them, because you'll absolutely love them. But you take these amazing photographs and you learn things about almost the smallest portion. I mean, granted, we're not talking about bacteria, viruses, things that are really small that you can't see with your naked eye, but things that even if I were walking through the rainforest, I would completely overlook. I'd be taken aback by, you know, the larger organisms there, the big birds, the trees and things like that. But you notice these tiny little things and you're really building a career on it. One thing that you guys might remember is a recent, It got a lot of press maybe
About two years ago.
I remember I was working as the science correspondent at the Huffington Post. I hadn't even met you yet. Mm-hmm. This is so serendipitous, too. It's like I know you from your research. When you discover these really interesting web-like structures, right?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that.
So we call it the decoy spider. Mm-hmm. And basically, it kind of blew our mind. I was out there with actually another science communicator, Destin, from Smarter Every Day.
Oh, yeah.
And the sound guy there points to this spider in a web, and he says, hey, I think this is a dead spider. And I went up to it, and I was like, that doesn't quite look like a dead. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is a spider-like form that a tiny spider constructed from scratch. It made a body. It made eight legs. It's crazy.
And it's made out of, like forest stuff.
Yeah, forest stuff.
Like other dead spiders.
Yeah, so it'll take little bits of leaf that fall into its web. Whatever it eats, it then incorporates into its little home that looks like a big giant spider. And it's a defense mechanism as far as we can tell. Basically, when we approach it, it'll shake that big decoy spider back and forth. And we think that we know there's specialists down there that feed on spiders. Things like hummingbirds, these big types of damselflies. So it's probably a really well-evolved defense against that. And it was a really fascinating thing, but I just assumed, I was like, somebody must have seen this before. Asked around, and nobody had.
Wow.
And what's actually really amazing about it is I found that one there, and then a buddy of mine who I now collaborate with all the time, 11,000 miles away in the Philippines, found the exact same thing in the exact same genus. This genus Cyclosa, it also makes a body and it makes all these legs to look like a bigger spider.
So
and
the only species difference is because they're in such disparate areas,
yeah.
But it comes from, it's almost the same spider.
It's almost the same spider. It's just a really beautiful example of convergent evolution where they evolved the same behavior, the same thing, but completely independently. There's just all this selective pressure that over a long period of time made these really incredible behaviors. So it was, what we just couldn't believe was that 2 months apart we discovered these things.
And that,
there's been scientists in these areas for decades.
And that across the world you discovered these two things. As you said, it's a type of evolution that it couldn't possibly be that these two organisms were in the same place, split off from one another, and then continued to evolve, because mm-hmm. they're just way too far apart from one another for that to be a reasonable explanation, right? So they just have very similar evolutionary pressures and develop the same exact mechanism.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely fascinating. How much do you feel like the work that you do in the rainforest is kind of a final frontier, as it were? You know, it seems like there's a group of scientists at any given time that are on the cusp of discovery. Some people turn to neuroscience because trying to understand how mind comes from brain is something that we haven't quite grasped. A lot of people turn to astronomy or planetary science for that same reason, because there's stuff out there and we haven't discovered. And when you go to the Amazon, it's right here in our own home planet. But I mean, the fact that you can discover a whole new insect is just crazy.
I mean, over my time doing expeditions, I've helped discover probably 40, 45 new species.
That's insane.
But that's
Phil.
like that's like small, that's nothing. For entomologists, that happens all the time. The hard part is really describing them, writing the paper, all that. What I love to do is find these new behaviors and these things that really just, there's no other animal that was known before that could make a fake animal.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty cool thing to be the one to find something that can do that. So I'll tell you what, when you're out in the Amazon someday, hopefully, Carrie, you'll join me out there.
God, it would be amazing. We'll do a Talk Nerdy podcast on the Amazon.
Yes, and we'll be walking around.
Oh, my God.
We'll hear all those crickets you're such a fan of.
I hate crickets, you guys.
I will change her ways, guys.
I really hate crickets. They're the worst.
Every single night when you're out there, you will see something new. And every time I'm like, I can almost guarantee nobody's ever seen that behavior before, or that's a new species, just left and right. So there's so much to be discovered. And I was just one person at this remote research station. Imagine if we had a full team out there dedicating a long period of time, if we had more scientists like that. And we're losing these areas of the Amazon relatively quickly. Luckily, that area is pretty well preserved, but illegal gold mining is right around the corner.
Is that a big problem right now?
It is.
Gold mining?
Yeah, where I worked in Ecuador, oil was the big issue. So the oil companies were coming into the local town and basically lying to them about the condition of the rainforest that was there. They told them there's only 52 species of plants in the entire jungle next to them. And for that reason, they shouldn't protect it and they should sell it to the oil people. And I told them, I was like, I'm looking outside and I can see more than 52 species of plants. Like, it got really frustrating. And then in Peru, the illegal gold mining is a really big issue.
And all of it is deforestation. They're clearing the forest in order to access things that are either underground or
And with gold mining, it's worse because it's not just cutting down the trees. They then take all of that soil and completely flip it over.
Huh.
So you get these areas that look like a desert in the middle of the rainforest.
They look like a desert in an area that should be the most lush, have the most amount of diversity possible.
Yeah. And not to mention all the mercury poisoning that's happening there.
What's causing the mercury poisoning?
So that's how they get the gold out, is they process it, they isolate it on these carpets, they do all these pumps, and then they shake it into a bucket, then they throw mercury in there, and that binds to the gold and makes some amalgam
or
something.
Yeah, it's similar to, I think they historically have used cyanide for that same purpose, because it draws the gold out. So then this is in the ground, and it's probably leaching into the groundwater.
It's in the ground. It goes into the air when they burn it off, so it's in the rainwater, too, and it's in the people who are using it. It's in the fish. It's not very good.
And we think of, I think that when we, you know, here in the States, but also probably across the world, those of us who live in really urban areas, we think of the rainforest as something that's sort of very far away, something that's a bit alien to us, the last kind of oasis in many ways of diversity and of life on the planet. And I think we all, even from the time we grew up when we were kids, remember rally cries of like, save the rainforest, don't let people go in and chop down the trees, don't buy tropical, you know, hardwoods. But I'm not sure that we really understand the extent to which that damage occurs, having not seen it firsthand.
Yeah, I used to just think it was simple deforestation. I used to think it was just the wood being shipped out, but it's so complex. Mm. It's also what people are doing inside the forest. So it's called empty forest syndrome, where the people nearby will just hunt out everything in there. So you have what looks like a rainforest, but you walk in, you don't hear the monkeys, you don't see jaguar prints. There's nothing in there.
I see. And why is that? Like, what kind of organisms are they? They're hunting for food?
They're hunting for food. So people will be hunting the monkeys, the peccary, and then the jaguars are the things that the peccary, sorry.
Do people eat jaguar?
No.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure.
The jaguars eat the peccary that are hunted out.
I see. And do people eat the monkeys?
Yeah, for sure. Unless they're like the really small species.
I couldn't eat a monkey.
But there's
a
difference. I mean, there's definitely native populations in there. Yeah, I would eat a monkey.
Really? You eat a monkey?
If I was eating it with the native populations. There are indigenous people that I've met, and they really live off the land still as they have for hundreds of generations.
Well, and they have
there.
Small populations that are kind of in step with nature. They're not overpopulating and overwhelming the nature around them.
Yeah. And one of the things that really stood out to me is I realized the impact that we have here on a daily basis. When I asked one of the guys down there, how does the economic downturn of a few years ago affect people in the rainforest? He said, when the economy of the U.S. went down, the price of gold shot up. And do you know where everybody went who was working those farms in those towns? They left their farm and they went out and started gold mining.
Wow.
Because that's where the money was. So, I mean, so they got to make
a
living.
A direct consequence, too, of our actions. It's not so much just don't buy tropical hardwoods, but just be really mindful of the kinds of decisions that we're making, because obviously they don't just end up in our backyard.
Right.
And they end up in Phil's backyard, you guys.
Yes, my second backyard.
I have to ask, though, like you were talking about, you know, this is just one person out there finding this one thing. Imagine if there were, you know, teams of tens or hundreds of people. Does it take a special kind of disposition? Do you have a special genetic profile that allows you to be unafraid of spending hours upon hours in the rain? I want to visit the Amazon, but I'm scared. I think I'm a little scared.
So I think there's two parts to that. One, I always say when I talk to other field biologists, and there are many out there doing amazing work. I was saying I'm the only one in that little patch, but there's so many out there.
Yeah.
But I always say you have to be able to let go of a certain thing. I don't know what it is, but by day three, you smell terrible. All your clothes are wet. You've been bit. You've been stung. You're cut up. You're out like really long hours carrying all this gear. You're not getting your data. You have to be able to kind of let go and just kind of deal with those conditions, which can be difficult from here. Also, we called it the jungle scareds. Every once in a while.
So you've had them too?
I have had them. Okay. After our first jaguar sighting at night, I didn't really know what to do with the jaguar. We kind of got freaked out. And then for the next couple of weeks, like me and the other guy I was working with, he's a pretty tough dude, we called it the jungle scareds, where if you were like on the far side of a transect going through the forest, you just kind of get scared.
It's jumpy.
You'd get a little jumpy and just that thought of turning around. Yeah. And it does. And what you have to realize is, I mean, A, these jaguars really aren't going to get you. And B, what we would do is just focus on what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And I think if you can really lose yourself to just trying to discover this thing, get that data, find those frogs. I've spent just so many hours looking for frogs or snakes or spiders or whatever at night, depending on what we were trying to study.
Uh-huh.
And you just make a game out of it and you just get fascinated and just take little mental notes the whole night. And that's what that experience in the Amazon really taught me is, when I was taking those little mental notes, I would see these patterns that when I came back to the U.S. and talked to professors, they never saw them. And so all that time being in the field, I was able to start to draw some conclusions and form some really interesting hypotheses that I wanted to go out and test.
Well, and that really does seem to be, I think, unique to the life of a naturalist, is that once you become so comfortable with a new environment, you probably start to notice things that you didn't notice before because you're acclimating in such a way that a lot of the bombardment of sensory information that is novel to you starts to calm. And then you can see through the noise to things that maybe other people can't see because they're so overwhelmed with the newness of the situation. And at this point, like you've spent, you know, many, many days, weeks in the rainforest, and you've probably been able to acclimate to some extent. I wonder, I mean, obviously it's possible to fully acclimate to the rainforest. There are people that live in the rainforest, but how much do you feel like when you come home after your field work, is it a bit odd to readjust?
So my first stint, I was basically in remote Ecuador for most of a year. I only came back to the U.S. for about 4 days over Christmas. So after coming back from that, I would just go into this mode where I was just like, where am I? And my sister had just done a really cool TV show called Stars Earn Stripes, where she teamed up with a special forces guy and they did all these competitions and stuff. So I went to their like rap party and it was at like the Beverly Hills Hotel. David Beckham was next to me. And I just remember like looking up at the trees next to me and just be like, I just want to go jump in those trees and just sit there and hide. Like, it was so weird. I was like, what is this life? And, you know, everybody there was so nice and were asking questions. Like, you know, not to say that the people were bad, but it was just the environment was so strange.
Different.
But now I've gone back and forth enough that when I get there, I'm like, oh, jungle mode. I just can't wait to get out every night. And then when I get back here, like, I like cities. I like being able to walk and eat grub and all that good stuff.
So it does become, after a while, a flip that you can kind of switch. You know what? Did I say that wrong? A switch you can flip. Do you flip the switch?
Do you switch a switch or flip a...
You flip a switch. You don't switch a flip. I said that backward. All right. On that note, You mentioned earlier that you were looking for frogs in the
I did mention that
in the rainforest, and before we started recording, you also mentioned that you wrote a new song about frogs, and I was wondering if maybe you would play that song.
Maybe I will.
You happen to have a guitar right next to you.
What is this thing? So I have to give you the backstory.
All right.
So me and one of the other one of my interns there, we were just joking around about some band that he just made up a band name.
Okay.
And then there was a song called Road Ever Wider because we were studying the impact of a road on a rainforest. And what we were finding is it was basically splitting the rainforest in two. So things like frogs that need that kind of moisture can't cross this dry road to the other side.
Oh, wow.
So they were like, some people there made us a bet. They're like, we bet you can't make a song called Road Ever Wider. And we're like, oh, you want to bet?
Oh, no.
So a week later, we made just the cheesiest, stupidest song.
Yes.
So I'm going to sing it very seriously for you guys. And just to let you know, I will say things like Pristimantis. That's a genus of frog. I'll say Kitchwarum, Venulosa. So every once in a while, there'll be a scientific term.
So mostly just, you're talking about frogs.
Mostly I'm talking about some frogs here.
All right, guys. World premiere, The Road Ever
Road Ever Wider.
Road Ever Wider.
I'll try not to cry.
Right.
On this road ever wider, couldn't decide her just where I'm hopping to, if I should come or go. On this road ever wider, I knew a spider. He was my friend. Now he's just part of the band. Trees are falling, baby, I'm calling. Uh-oh. Been a little while. Trees are falling, baby, I'm calling. Ribbit, ribbit, can you hear me from the other side? Now they're putting down this asphalt. Wasn't my fault, I don't know. I'm just a frog on the go. On this road ever wider, what a divider. Will my loved ones wait for me? I guess we'll wait and see. Tell my tadpoles, don't you worry, daddy'll hurry across this tarmac. I'll come back for you.
Aww.
A trail of rock and stone wasn't worth my home. I don't know. I'm just a frog on the go home. Pristimantis, I can't stand this heat. What's this sticking to my feet? They weren't designed for this. Kitchwarum, how much farther must I go? I see your face and then I'll know I finally made it home. Venulosa, it gets closer, wow. Listen to that engine growl on this road ever wider. You know what I miss the most? Now that I'm just a froggy ghost, I couldn't avoid that tire. On the road ever wider. Splat!
Oh, that's
so sad! So,
you probably couldn't hear that from across the room, but our very own Crystal Dilworth is sitting here enjoying the show, and she just tweeted to everybody that they just missed Phil winning all podcasts on Talk Nerdy.
I hope you guys felt that emotion.
I felt the emotion. I kind of felt bad. It was hilarious, but then the frog died, and yeah, I was like, I'm laughing.
It is a real issue out there, but yeah.
Yeah.
So. Might have messed up the guitar in there. Should have practiced, but.
Oh, no, no. That was perfect. It was perfect. I think people were really feeling it. They were feeling it. You're going to get some tweets, Phil.
All right.
You're going to get some tweets. Wow. So this is what you do in the rainforest.
Yeah. You know, as hard as you work out there, you need your downtime.
Sure.
And there's always a guitar lying around. And so you just pick it up and write a song.
Little known fact, there's always a guitar in the rainforest.
That is actually true. That is the biggest export. They just cut down trees and they turn into
guitars. They turn them into guitars. But so then you can write songs about dead frogs.
Yes.
Jesus Christ. So I would be remiss if I didn't share with everybody listening today, and I won't be sharing it because I can't tell the story nearly as well as Phil can because it didn't happen to me. It happened to Phil, but Phil and I were on a shoot. We bonded a bit when we went to Davis, California.
Davis, California.
Yeah. Because we went to spend the night in the Honda Smart Home for an episode of Techno. We had a slumber party and learned all about this really cool energy efficient home. And while we were there, actually on the way back, we had some time to kill in the airport, and Phil told me a delightful story about his early days in science communication.
A little tale about my eyeball.
And it's just too good to not share. So I asked him before we started recording if he was comfortable telling the story here on air, and he graciously accepted this challenge. So, Phil, how old are you now?
I'm 28.
Phil is 28 years old. He's a very accomplished 28-year-old. When he was 22?
Yeah, probably 22,
about 22, you were first kind of venturing into the world of TV science.
Yes.
And you made some mistakes.
I made some decisions that I maybe regret.
All right. So you were working on, you agreed to do a TV show for an unnamed network, unnamed TV show for an unnamed network, to keep legal concerns out of this, in which you signed a waiver that maybe you shouldn't have.
Yeah, it was like 10 pages long. That should have been a warning. But I was just like, sure, it's TV. I got this. This is my big break.
Yeah, yeah. So this is long before an agent was looking out for him.
Of course.
So what was the show to be about?
So basically the way they told me it, they're like, imagine Jackass meets Mythbusters, right? So there's all these like animal mysteries out there that can cause pain and we don't know about them. So how about you and the other guys on your team are like human guinea pigs, basically. So it'd be things like, which hurts worse, a taser or an electric eel? Or like, can you actually run away from killer bees? And I was like, I mean, that sounds really fun. And actually, as a scientist, if I were able to do all these things, that'd be a pretty interesting perspective to have.
Sure.
So I'm like, count me in, guys. What's up first? So spitting cobras, you guys. They brought in African spitting cobra. And basically, we had like an expert on spitting cobras, two venom experts, an ER doc there. And they're like, okay, so in the textbooks, it says if you get spitting cobra venom in your eye, you're supposed to use either beer, milk, or urine. Because that's generally what people have out in the bush. When they get this, that's the liquid they have nearby, so that's what they use. And it's literally written in the textbook to do that. Mm-hmm. So we're like, all right, it's on. Let's see which of those work. So there's three of us in this team, and first we had to get household item in our eye just to set the pain level. So I got shampoo in my left eye, and I was like, that stings, but it was like funny sting. So I gave it like a 4.5 out of 10.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. One of the other guys got lime juice, another got Tabasco.
Both of those sound painful.
I lucked out with that one.
Yeah, but I mean, we've all had shampoo in our eyes. It hurts.
Right. It does hurts. Hurt. Yeah. So I was like laughing. I was like, haha, this is all fun so far. So then the next part is to actually get, well, no. Let's take a step back.
Okay.
First, you get to dodge a spitting cobra. So for those of you who don't know, a cobra, you know, the big snake that hoods up, there are types that spit their venom, and it's like 90% accurate up to 6 feet. And it's a great defense. If something is trying to eat it, they just spit this venom in their eye. This venom evolved to destroy corneal tissue. It evolved to, like, eat your eyeball, basically.
Did you know this at the time?
I did. Again, what a great decision. So the first part was great. We put on goggles. There was a spitting cobra on one end, us three on the other end, and we had to dodge this cobra spitting at us. And it was like a blast. Like, I was like, this is a story I'm going to tell my kids someday.
Did it hit you?
It hit some of the guys in the arm, but we were basically just kind of dodging around. And when it got on your skin, yeah, it was fun. Like,
it burned,
that's a cool
but you could
thing.
Wash it off.
Yeah, totally.
And you're wearing goggles.
We were wearing goggles.
Yeah.
All fun and games.
Totally. That seems completely safe.
Yes. Hey, the things I do for science.
Exactly.
Right?
We thank you, Phil.
Well, you're welcome.
All right. But it obviously gets a lot
It takes
worse than
a
this.
Turn for yeah. the interesting. So we had already had the household item, but then we have to test out the remedies of cobra venom. And how do you test out the remedies of cobra venom? You get the venom in your eye. So the first guy goes, they strap him down in this big chair. This dude is much larger than me, much tougher. He's got tattoos. He is like, he's been shot. He's been bit by snakes. Like, he's a tough dude.
Uh-huh.
And then he goes, so they dilute the venom about 100 to 1.
Okay,
and
so this is not straight cobra venom.
It's not straight cobra venom. I'm not that crazy, all right? But all the experts there were like, you guys are going to have to act to make it seem like it hurts. And we were like,
because
it was so diluted.
And they didn't actually want to harm you.
Right, exactly. So the first guy goes, and we have him like hooked up to like different heart monitors, all this stuff with the ER doc there, just to make sure we don't die.
Mm-hmm,
And he turns beet red, his heart goes crazy. And he, keep in mind, this guy's been shot, okay? And he says, he gives it a 9.5 out of 10. He says it's the most pain he has ever been in his entire life.
So why not a 10?
He said if it was a 10, he would have passed out.
Oh.
But he was still talking to us barely and Goody. Just like shaking. And his remedy that we all drew straws for the remedy, his remedy was beer.
Okay.
And we learned later that the carbonation from beer is not good for a damaged eyeball and actually made his eye worse.
Oh, no.
But then little old me, I'm like not a tough big dude who's been shot.
So you're watching this guy.
I'm watching this.
This guy goes first.
Yeah, so roll cameras and they strap me down into this chair. You see me the most scared I've ever been in my life. I'm just shaking, but I'm like, okay, big network.
So
hopefully
this is way worse than
out.
The Forest Scareds.
Yes, this is a whole different level because I'm like, what am I doing? Am I going
to
regret this?
Yeah, it's one thing to go into it blind, no pun intended. Yeah. It's one thing to go into it not knowing what to expect. It's another thing to see this big, scary dude basically brought to his knees.
This is like beyond adrenaline. This is just like your body's like, well, here it comes.
Oh, jeez.
So they strap me down, they lean my head back, and they put a drop of the venom in. Uh-huh. And for the first like 3-5 seconds, didn't really feel much, and then it just... Only way I can describe it, just cranks up, and my face just clenches and everything was crazy. And they're like, can you describe the pain for us? I was like, it feels like holding a lighter up to your eyeball.
Ugh.
If you can imagine what that feels like, it was just so painful. So first you have me the most scared I've ever been. Then you have me in the most pain I've ever been. And then it gets better because my remedy was urine. So then you see them pour my own piss all over my face and my eye. And so that's like my shining moment of my life.
Oh, no.
The pain was so bad that both of us had to go to the ER afterwards. I was on a saline drip. I was on morphine. My eye was just swollen and nasty, and I can give you that photo of the swollen nastiness. It was pretty bad for about 2 weeks.
So wait, how long are you in the ER?
I was in the ER just basically till the next day.
You had to stay overnight.
Yeah, definitely stay overnight. And then the next 2 weeks, I was on Vicodin. I was using all these drops. I looked like crazy person.
Yeah, like your eyes were swollen.
Yeah, I was just completely swollen
and was
red.
It just half of your face? Like, did they only do one eyeball?
Yeah, only one eyeball.
So you could see the difference really
dramatically. Yes, it is pretty dramatic. And when I went back to the doc, I'd go for checkups every 5 days. They had to make sure that my eyeball didn't heal to the eye socket behind it.
What?
Do you know how they did that? It's not some like magical doctor thing. They take a really long Q-tip and shove it to the back of your eyeball
and move it
around to make sure nothing's healing against
Wait,
each other.
You can
other.
Stick a Q-tip. Well, don't try this
you,
at home.
Oh,
you can technically
gosh.
Stick a Q-tip
Apparently
under
you
your
can
eyelid.
Because
and
they did it to me and just to the back. And so like you go to the doctor. The first time I went for a checkup, I was like, oh, these people are going to heal me. They're going to make me feel better.
No.
I walked out just like I felt so violated.
Oh,
it was
my God.
Awful.
Does that – I mean, did – that hurt worse than your eye at this point?
I think that was worse just because my expectation was I was going to go here, I've been in so much pain, they're going to just make me feel a little bit better. But no, they were just like, we're going to stick this in your eye.
So it was more like scary and dramatic and, like you said, violating.
Violating is the, yeah.
And at this point, it's been a few days. You're going back every few days to make sure your eyeball doesn't fuse to your fucking eye socket, which is insane. And is your eye still in pain?
It is still in pain. It's watering a lot. Okay. And my vision is pretty blurry. So there was always that concern there. I was like, what if I don't get my vision back? That would kind of suck. What was that 10-page document I signed? But I'm a pretty optimistic person. And I still, as I was going through it, I was like, you know what? This will be a good story someday. I could tell it to Cara Santa Maria. So I was like, you know what? Just hope for the best. See what happens. They sent me to the Jules Stein Eye Institute, UCLA. They're like the best of the best.
Okay.
So what was really interesting is they were able to watch the healing and monitor the healing of my eye, and in a way that no other ophthalmologist has been able to do anywhere. It's very uncommon for spitting cobra venoms to show up at like the best eye institute in the world, right?
Right, because this only really happens to it's rare that it happens anyway. And when it does happen, it's probably happening to people, like you said, in the bush. People who are
and
out
not
where.
Not necessarily in like Westwood. Yeah. So it took about 6 months for the vision to get back.
Jesus Christ.
A full year for like the kind of the halo at night. My eyes still, that's the one that gets irritated first. I have to change that contact all the time.
Did the unnamed show pay for your doctor visit?
Yeah, they covered my medical stuff. And I had insurance and stuff. So they like, yeah, they helped me out a little.
that's good.
But
learning experience.
Uh-huh. But also with that, what I'm happy about is through being with those ophthalmologists, they got a really cool medical paper out of it. And so you can look and there's like, you know, a rare case of spitting cobra, whatever, in LA, and they monitor the healing out of it. So
you can go to PubMed and read about your eyeball.
You absolutely can. If you look on PubMed and search for spitting cobra venom, I think I'm like the number one hit. I'm kind of a big deal on PubMed, guys. So it went to science. It went for good. When I was first getting treated at Cedars-Sinai. That was the emergency room I went to. About 2 years later, I met a nurse that worked there. And I was like, hey, did you ever hear about this spitting cobra guy? She was like, yeah, I went and saw him. I was like the like sideshow there. I remember when I was on morphine, all these doctors and nurses would come and just look at me and be like, who's this clown?
Oh, my God. You and were so famous. I was she like, was like, yeah, I totally remember.
I'm kind of a big deal. My
like,
face
that was
looked
me.
Like, look at the right side of my face.
Oh, my God. Phil, you're my favorite. You're my absolute favorite. Now I understand why the producer send you to go out on the shark tagging trip.
It was a blast.
And you actually did a really cool episode of Techno once with the jaguars that you were mentioning earlier with camera traps.
Yeah.
And what rainforest was that? Was that in the Amazon?
So yeah, it's in the Amazon. It's an area called Tambopata where I did a bunch of my spider research and stuff. And one of the other things we're looking at is just mammal population there. We're working on getting a big project to have camera traps and live streaming video and all this fun stuff out there. So to attract jaguars, some of my friends work with them in Costa Rica, and they were saying they use a certain thing to attract them to these camera traps.
Mm-hmm.
And what they use is actually cologne. But it's not any old cologne. It is Calvin Klein Obsession for Men.
Only Calvin Klein Obsession for Men.
Well, now they also use Chanel No. 5 because these Jags have some posh taste. You know, they're like, oh, Calvin Klein doesn't do it anymore.
Oh, my God. Okay, so Calvin Klein Obsession for Men, Chanel No. 5, something in those perfumes?
Yes, so the thought is there's an ingredient called civetone that used to come from the civet glands. But now
what's
they make it.
Gland?
So the civet is a weird animal. I want to say it's like a mustel, like it's related to weasel or something.
Okay. Okay.
And they look kind of cat-like. I think they're found in like India, maybe Africa. I might be making up some of these.
That's
stats.
Fine. Yeah. We'll Google it right now. Yeah.
and basically, they used to be used to. Their glands have this really strong scent that was used by perfumers. But it was a really bad conditions for these animals. So finally, some guy figured out how to make it synthetically.
They're so cute.
They are pretty
I'm
adorable.
Looking them up right now. And you're right. Asia and Africa. Tropical Asia and Africa. It's a nocturnal mammal, small, lithe bodied, whatever that means. Really cute with spots. Okay, sorry.
And okay. what's really interesting is that scent comes from Asia and Africa, right? Mm-hmm. But yet we were using it in South America and Central America.
Oh, yeah. That
so
is so
we think
strange.
There's just some, it's a very like mammal-y territory, something scent that seems to work.
So what do you, set up a camera trap.
Yep.
Do you just spray the ground around
No, so I'd put a stick in the ground and I'd wrap a half a sock around it. Very precise with my methods. And then you spray that sock a bunch of times.
Uh-huh.
And then it really works.
Does it attract them? And I mean, there may be no way to know, but does it attract them like in an aggressive territorial way or is it in a sexual
way? I think it's a pretty curious way because they do this cheek rubbing behavior where they rub their cheek against it and they have their own kind of glands and sensors there.
Well, almost like when your house cat does
that. Yeah, exactly.
So that's almost
that same behavior. Yeah.
Interesting.
And it's kind of it's a territory investigative thing. And what is really helpful for scientists is they could put little patches of like tape on that. And then when the jaguar comes and rubs its cheek, that tape is going to collect some of those hairs. From the hair, you can get DNA and do all sorts of cool analyses to look at the population density.
And you never to interact with that cat as a human. You never have to capture it.
Yeah.
You never have to tranquilize it, do anything that could be really detrimental to its health or its well-being in that habitat.
It's quite non-invasive. There are some other methods that don't use a lure. There are some people that aren't too keen on using lures because it still alters their behavior a little bit. And you don't want to draw in too many in one area.
I'm sure
but
they get over
I'd say it's for the greater good. Yeah.
I'm sure, because how long do you leave a camera trap up?
It depends. I mean, when it's that, you have to go back and spray it every couple of days. So
a few
days.
So a few days, and then it's back to just a sock in the ground,
just
like they're used
sock,
to seeing.
Yeah. Just feels stinky. So
I'm assuming. Do you use clean socks or do you use your old stinky socks?
I mean, clean is a very interesting word when you're out there. So it's like jungle clean. But there's been times where like I like do all my laundry in the jungle, and then I go out to a town, and I'll like take a shower and go back into my room and I smell something. I'm like, what is that awful smell? And I realize it's my bag.
It's
and
your
all
clean
of my
laundry.
Supposedly clean clothes. And I'm just like, oh my gosh. So you pretty much smell awful all the time. You just kind of get acclimated.
Sure.
It's not until you scrub off and you smell your clothes again that you're like, I am disgusting.
Well, you know, it's funny because you have this kind of sensory adaptation that we talk about it all the time in neuroscience, all of your senses, you know, you have a sensory adaptation to smells. You don't smell them after you've been in a certain place. You have sensory adaptation to temperature, to certain noises.
To touch.
Even, to touch. Like, think about your clothing. Like, you don't feel your clothes on you all day. Like,
That'd
if you did,
really
that would be
awkward,
really annoying.
Yeah.
Only if you have, like, an itchy tag or something do you notice it. And I think one of the most extreme examples of that you hear about is the International Space Station. Anytime you ever have a chance to interview an astronaut, I recommend it. They're quite interesting.
Okay.
Talk to an astronaut and ask them if they've been to the space station, what it's like when they first go into it. Because they say the smell is just
stifling. I'm actually interviewing Chris Hadfield next month.
Oh, my God.
So I'm going to ask him
talk
about the smell.
Talk to him
number
about
one
how
question.
Bad. Yeah, because if you think about it, in the ISS, there's no chamber where you get to just, you know, cycle the air. The air is moving around all day, but it's like being in an airplane for months at a time where it's just recycled, reconditioned air. All of the skin flakes, all of the sweat, everything just stays there. And apparently it is just, and I mean, you go to the bathroom, any scent that arises from that.
I think we should request a jar of air from the next astronauts that come down.
Seriously, because I've just heard that it's like overwhelmingly stifling when you first walk in, and then within days it's just you don't even notice it. You know, so thank goodness for that. Thank goodness for sensory adaptation. Yes. Otherwise it would be really tough.
Thank you, sensory adaptation.
The more you know.
Shout out to sensory adaptation.
What So what, tell me a little bit about some of the stories that you have coming up or that you've recently done on Techno.
So I'm pretty excited to be interviewing Chris Hadfield.
That's awesome. He's so cool.
I just absolutely love what he did in space. Was every single time he tweeted, it was this moment that you would have. You'd be like, there's somebody up in space taking these photos, writing this like poetry about
them. Yeah, he really, really has a gift for his science and his work, and then taking that and speaking to people who are fundamentally non-scientists. Like he can speak to scientists and non-scientists alike in a way that really just evokes an emotional response that makes you so, I don't know, excited for the work that he's doing. And granted, there are a lot of amazing astronauts who are very good at this. I think it's a big part of their job is inspiring young people and getting people excited about space exploration. But there's something very special about what would his name be? Captain Commander?
Commander
Hadfield. Yeah. Something very special. And if you don't follow him on Twitter, I definitely recommend you do it. Yes. He has like millions of followers.
And like Google best of Chris Hadfield, and you'll be like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. And his videos that he did were so amazing. Did you see the one where he wrings out a towel?
Yes.
Oh, that blew my mind.
So cool. Zero Gravity is so cool.
I want Zero Gravity now.
I know. And now all of the, I heard, or people have been kind of passing around that they're now going to have like really good espresso in the ISS.
Oh, dang.
So good for you, astronaut.
Good for you. You deserve it.
You deserve it. You waited long enough.
Nasty air will smell a little more coffee-like.
So what are you, how are you going to interview him? Are you going to interview him in person?
We're working on that. It may just be a Skype interview, but hopefully I can get up there and talk to him.
You know what one of my first assignments was when I started working at the Huffington Post is, I think it was week one, when they Ariana hired me. She said, we're starting a new science page. I'd love for you to be involved. I'd love for you to take, at the time I had done a pilot on HBO called Talk Nerdy to Me, and she had seen it. And she said, I'd love for you to take those principles and apply them to the web and do a video series. And I was like, okay, that sounds awesome. And one of the very first opportunities I had was I got a 10-minute satellite hit with the ISS.
What?
So I got to interview Don Pettit and Dan Burbank. I hope I'm not mixing up their first names. And ask them questions that we had crowdsourced. And people had the most amazing questions. Like, do you lose the concept of up and down? How much vertigo does that give you? Are your dreams different in space? What does space smell like? And that was one, I think, one of the most telling for me was that Pettit told us that when he would go out on a spacewalk and then come back in the airlock when he first removed his gear, there was a really striking smell of hot metal.
Whoa.
That was lingering in the airlock, which is just amazing. And then, of course, everybody asks about poop and pee and barf and stuff like that. And it's like, how do you barf in space? And I remember one of the guys was like, you don't. You swallow it. He was like, if you feel sick, and it happens, if you're on the ISS and you feel sick, you either cleanly barf into a bag or you swallow it. Because if you can't, all that shit that comes out of your mouth just fly. The same thing you saw when he wrung out the towel.
Yeah.
Can you imagine just barfing?
Oh my gosh.
And it just goes everywhere and it gets clogged up in all the controls. It's like super
gross.
Those
are some tough cookies up there.
I know. These men and women are so strong. Yeah, you're right. They're the best of the best. They're fascinating. I can't wait for you to interview Commander Hatfield because you're going to.
Very excited.
Yeah, it's going to be really.
Also, after that interview, I think I'm doing a follow up to one of your favorite things of eating bugs.
Oh, gross. We had a night. It was the same night you were showing us all those pretty pictures.
Oh, yeah.
He made bugs and tried to make. He made everybody eat them except me. I think
forced everybody.
I think
guys,
I'm the only one
Kara
who refused.
Didn't do it. Can we start a Twitter thing that said Kara eat bugs? Hashtag Kara eat bugs.
You know what? You had a bag on your counter of like meal. Was it cricket meal?
Yeah, it was basically ground up cricket flour that. They're like cricket pancakes, basically. And they taste amazing.
I would eat that. I would totally eat that. My problem is having an entire insect in my mouth and like being able to tactily. I have a hard time with texture anyway. Grub worms, maybe I could have done, or like chocolate covered ants or something. But when they become large, also I have a thing about crickets, but when they become large and you can make out their wings and their legs and their.
It is a bit of a challenge. It was a challenge for me.
Really?
Even though I know these things, I know they're tasty, I know they're healthy. But a lot of the mental game is just seeing them as land shrimp.
Yes.
Because they're insects are basically within crustacea. So they are just a land version of a shrimp.
But I don't eat shrimp. Well, I don't eat seafood. Remember the very first episode of Techno?
Oh, yeah.
They sent me out. It was all about genetically modified salmon. And we went out on like a family salmon fishing boat. And they had live caught shrimp, and they were cooking them up with truffle butter, and it was Ketchikan, Alaska, the freshest salmon, the freshest shrimp you could get. And I'd be like, no thanks, I'll have the reindeer.
I was so upset with you. I just met her and I'm kind of angry. She should have brought us that salmon back.
Everybody was so pissed. I was like, I'm sorry, I don't like seafood. I'm weird. But there's something about seeing the whole animal.
Mm-hmm.
Its head still on it, its tail's flopping around, all of the anatomy is in place. I'm getting to the point where it's harder and harder for me to even eat. And this is a whole other conversation about climate change that we could have separately, right. That I've been really exploring. And don't get me wrong, it's like practice what I preach or do as I say, not as I do. I'm still really bad. I'm a Texan. I'm learning. I eat a lot of meat. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. But I am getting to the point where it's harder and harder for me to eat meat that is really anatomically correct. It's much easier to eat like a filet or Got to it. Eat a chicken breast that's been deboned, which in some ways getting away from our food and getting away from the animals, I think really does us a disservice. But in other ways, I'm looking forward to the time when we can take a punch biopsy of any animal and then use a desktop machine or tabletop machine to create in vitro meat.
Heck yeah.
I want that.
That sounds delicious.
That sounds amazing. I want to try all sorts of animals that you can't try now because it would not be humane to do. If it means that we never have to kill another animal, mm-hmm. we never have to factory farm, we never have to do the things that are really bad for the environment. But because I love meat. But when I'm eating a chicken leg and I see the blood vessels and I see the tendons and I see, it just reminds me of teaching anatomy and physiology back when I was a professor. And I can't, it's so hard to stomach.
I kind of enjoy it. I feel like I kind of get into that like pure like omnivore role of just being a human. And
a lot of people do.
When I was in the Amazon, I remember there was one time when I went to visit the Warani tribe and they're very remote and they had just killed some peccary. They spear hunted these peccary and served us some of it. And so I was eating there with my buddy. He had never been to a jungle before, never been to a rainforest. And I look behind me and I'm like, oh, you got to see this. So I poke him. I'm like, hey, look behind you. There's a girl sitting there with the skull of this peccary, just scooping out the brains with her hands and just eating it out of her hand. And I was like, I love this. And there's just something I'm just like, that is human, you know? And so I sometimes can kind of get in the mode and I'm eating my chicken. I'm just like, yeah, this is like.
So you could probably do the whole bizarre foods with Andrew Zimmern thing. And
I think so. If I get into the right mode, get
my game face on. I'm like, oh, I'm so bad. I'm like, give me meat and potatoes. I'm so lame. I have no food. What's the word I'm looking for? Spontaneity? No. Whatever. I've got the jungle scared.
I've got the jungle scared
when it comes to food. It's terrible.
I get it. I mean, when I see a cow, I'm not like, that looks tasty. Like,
I know. There is a removal from it. Whereas I think I quote Sarah Silverman as saying this all the time, but I'm not sure if she actually did. So Sarah, I'm sorry if you didn't. But I'm pretty sure that she also doesn't eat seafood, that when asked why she doesn't eat a fish, her quote was something along the lines of, because when I saw a fish, I was like, why would I eat that? And that's exactly how I feel. There's nothing appetizing looking about seafood. And I feel the same way about insects. But insects are our future. Yeah. You know, when we look at the dramatic negative impact that we're having on the planet right now, we know that at a certain point, in order to sustain the billions of people on this planet in a healthy way, like you said, it's a very healthy, lean protein. It's accessible. There are enough of them. It doesn't require the types of farming that we need. Yeah,
very small carbon footprint.
Very small carbon footprint. And it's incredibly important that we kind of get over our heebie-jeebies. Mm-hmm. I think if they're ground up, you know what? I challenge thee. I will dine on the cricket meal.
Yes.
Just not a whole cricket
body.
Okay.
Baby steps. I like it. And that's what I think the cricket meal is so good for. Just introducing people to the idea of it.
Very cool.
But I would say eat bugs to save the world, because I really think if we ate more bugs, we would be helping save the world.
Let's do it. That's a great. Okay. Let's do it. Let's all nerdcore out there. Let's save the world and eat some bugs. All right, Phil, we're pretty much out of time, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you before you went the final two questions that I ask all of my guests when they come on the podcast, which is, number one, when you look to the future in whatever context you like, looking to the future, what is the thing that most concerns you? What is the thing that keeps you up at night? And on the flip side of that, thinking to the future, what are you most impassioned about? What are you most excited about?
So concern, I'd say, is education. Traveling around, I've seen how much value there is in education because of how useful it is to, you know, break out and create a career for yourself. I remember when I was in Mongolia, there was a girl, probably 11 years old, selling strawberries on this road. And by road, it's there's maybe three cars that pass the entire day. And she would just sit out there in the rain selling strawberries. And I was like, why is she selling them? They're like, because she wants to go to school. All of the entomologists we work with in Mongolia, they were all women, really valued education. And I think here in America, I've just seen things that concern me about the future of education and how much funding we're giving it.
And we really take it for granted, too. It's almost a luxury here that we treat as if, eh, yeah, we do it. We do it right, whatever. It doesn't need any improvement. It doesn't need any funding. And then you see people in other cultures where it's not a given that you get to go to school, where people are working so hard and sacrificing so much just to be able to go to school. I think our mentality needs to change about it. It's, yeah, we definitely take it for granted in this country.
Absolutely.
So, that's definitely a concern of mine as well. But
and also, I mean, one of my big things is if we are a democracy, you know, when people vote, you have to know things in order to vote correctly.
Yes,
I think it's really what it comes down to. If we're not learning enough, then we're not going to make the right decisions at the voting booth. And I, you know, I'm a big fan of democracy, and I, but I just think that if we're not emphasizing education, we're going to make some bad decisions.
That's true. And I mean, we've seen it historically, but definitely the less informed the populace is, the more, well, and also it's not just about making bad decisions or making decisions that aren't in our own best interest, but it's also about being more easily swindled, being more credulous, being more likely to do something because somebody convinced us it's the right thing to do and not because we've actually taken the time to do our due diligence and research it, which I think problem solving and learning how to make rational decisions is really a function of education. It's not a skill that we naturally possess as humans because we evolved in such a way that our we fall victim to a lot of kind of cognitive and perceptual tricks and biases. And we have to learn how to overcome those things to be able to think scientifically, which is a much broader term than it sounds like, because thinking scientifically really just means thinking. You know, it's kind of as simple as that. But on the flip side of that, you know, what are you looking forward to?
I'll tell you what, working with techno, I've been able to see more of the innovation side of science that I really hadn't seen before. And it just is so exciting to see what people are doing and how it's affecting people's lives. I got to interview this guy in Kentucky who is just this amazing man who lost both his arms and has these two bionic arms. And he was holding his son's hand with these robotic hands. He was cracking eggs for us, poured me a glass of water. I would forget that his hands were robots. It was
so
crazy.
Cool. He has robot hands.
He has robot hands. And yet he just had this amazing life and could was just so inspiring with it. Yeah. And you could just see how these innovations, these bright minds that pop up around the U.S., around the world, that are just creating things because they care and they want to make people's lives better. And that kind of innovative mind, I think I just keep meeting these people, young and old, and that gets me excited about the future.
Yeah, and that's something where I feel like regardless of the economic climate, regardless of the moral climate, the, you know, whatever negative thing we can say, there are bright shining stars in every culture who are solving problems with a lot or with very little. You know, we're seeing so much interesting innovation because we're also at a really, I think, important place in history where technology is getting to be cheaper and more widely available. So more people have access to technology like Wi-Fi or cellular technology, or they can buy computer chips. We can store more memory in smaller areas. And because of that, it's allowing us the flexibility to be able to do more. And I think that's something we'll continue to see with techno. Not that I'm plugging the show for you guys. It comes on
Saturdays
at
4:30 Pacific time.
4:30 Pacific, 7:30 Eastern.
Watch it.
I don't know why DVR it. I'm so bad about this. I'm on the damn show and I don't know what time it comes on. But yeah, really do actually check it out. It's a great show. Phil's amazing on it. We have fun on it. And Phil, before we go, why don't you tell everybody, you know, where they can find more about what you do, maybe see some of your incredible photography. Where can they find you and reach you?
You can reach me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Phil_Torres, and I'm always posting photos from the field and other good fun facts.
Awesome. Well, Phil, thank you so much for stopping
Thank
in.
Thank you.
It was a really great time. Thank you for entertaining us with your gift of song and spitting cobra venom story. And hey, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in, too. I look forward to the next time we get together to talk nerdy.